and I'd like to introduce Cindy A. from Tucson, Arizona.
Norman.
Hi. My name is Cindy. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's wonderful to be here. How are you all doing? Sitting and lying and leaning up against each other. I'd like to thank, first of all, the committee for asking me back. It's one thing to get invited to talk at an AA convention. It's another thing to get invited back. I love coming to Washington. You all have a beautiful kind of energy. I think if you pause just for a minute, you'll feel it again, like you did when Murray helped put us in touch with it. It's the healing energy of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's the main reason that today I identify myself as a member of AA. For me, it's an acknowledgement of my health, my happiness, the opportunity you've given me to live and love and learn. About 12 years ago, when I was trying to survive in a life that I had created, I was a drunken junkie. I believe today that that was a very spiritual search. As a matter of fact, as many of you know, a half a cc of morphine mainlined is the closest thing to God that isn't. I always thought somehow that somewhere, someday, someone or something would make me happy. Alcohol actually never made me happy, but it always made me feel like in about 15 minutes I was going to be happy. I chased that illusion for a long time through a lot of difficulties. I saw a beautiful button today on a wonderful young woman that said, "Please, one crisis at a time." That's possible in this fellowship. It was not possible as a drunken junkie. My life was a crisis at all times, in all places. I have come to understand that that was absolutely essential for me. There was no other way for me to learn how to live and love and laugh. I believe today with all of my heart and all of my soul that there are no mistakes. I have never made one, and you have never made one. I used to think that if I made a mistake, it meant I was one. And I lived that way for a long time. I know today that I have everything I have asked for. And I always have. I have always created the world I saw. Because I saw it that way, it was that way. And my drunkenness and my drug addiction were an expression of the fact that I believed life was a rotten deal. Now, I didn't grow up that way. I grew up in a beautiful home out in the country in Missouri, playing, having a wonderful time. I have beautiful family. I grew up in a church called Unity, which teaches that we are an expression of God, that the only way He has to speak is through each of us. And I spent a lot of my life trying to prove that that was wrong. I've recently adopted a song that today sort of rolls through my head a lot. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a very simple program. I went through a period in sobriety where it became very complicated, and I asked a lot of questions that had no answers. Today I've learned not to do that so often. And I have learned that a simple way to live my life is to sing a little song that goes, "Row, row, row your boat, gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream." Now think about it for a minute. It says, "Row your boat down the stream." That means you don't do very much, right? What it means for me is that I try not to row upstream. It's a very difficult proposition for me sometimes. I find myself fighting the way things are. And when I fight the way things are, I become uncomfortable, unhappy, and unpleasant to be around. That song also, if you'll notice, has four merrilies and only three rows. So I would only add one thing to the theme of this conference: living, loving, learning, and laughing. Laughter has saved my life, my sanity, my sobriety many times in the last 10 years. When I came to you, I had experienced all of the humiliation and degradation possible for a woman who is a drunken junkie. I had sold my heart and my soul so many times that I was amazed that I could do it again and again and again. There seemed to be no part of me untouched by the sordid unpleasantness of my life. The remarkable thing is that there was a part of me untouched, just enough left for you to find. And one day in January of 1972, I walked into a restaurant where I never went, and there was one seat available at a counter in that restaurant, and that turned out to be my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was conveniently arranged by God, as I understand God today, because it was a seat next to a wonderful, handsome man. God knows exactly what I need. What form it will take, what it should wear, how it should smile. So he sat me down that day in that restaurant next to that lovely, beautiful man. And I began to try to eat breakfast. I did not eat well in those days. Things didn't stay down unless they were liquid. And I had had a few drinks in order to try to help my breakfast stay down. I had been given an ultimatum by my boss, who said, "I believe the last few weeks have been the last few weeks." It appears that you have become more expensive than you're worth. I had been helping myself to his morphine. I was working for a veterinarian, as any good, clean junkie should do when they're not very serious about staying clean. And I told him when I went to work for him that I had once been a narcotics addict and that it would be very helpful if he would lock up his drugs. And he looked at me and he said something that people have said to me a lot over the years. He looked at me and he said, "Honey, I can tell by looking at you that you'll never do it again." And I agreed. And I didn't do it again for about 2 weeks. At which point I began borrowing 2 cc's of morphine, replacing it with 2 cc's of sterile water, checking it periodically to make sure it would still work on the dogs. And he began to notice that the dogs were screaming out in surgery and nothing bothered me. At any rate, he had helped me to at least want to change. I think a lot of you have had the experience of knowing that this is the last job and the last chance, and you're amazed you've got it, and you're going to try to keep it. So I said to him, I'll try to do something. I had no idea what. I had tried everything, I thought. And nothing had worked, fortunately. Because I believed sincerely at that point in my life that somewhere, someday, some drug, some man, or some job was going to make me perfectly, wonderfully happy. I had the illusion that outside somewhere in this world was something made for me. I had no idea what it was or how I'd find it, but when he said to me, you've got to do something, I agreed. What I did when we locked up the clinic that night was to go home for about a half an hour and then return to the clinic and take from the clinic a bottle of Demerol and a couple of clean syringes. The nice thing about not being a street junkie is not having to worry about the burrs on the needles and the rat poison in the heroin. And I had gotten to a nice, steady pace of scotch and morphine and Demerol, and I thought I had it figured out pretty well. So I took home what I thought I needed. I had a bottle of scotch and I had a bottle of Demerol. And I spent that night injecting Demerol and drinking scotch. Nothing happened. To this day, there is no good explanation for that. Everyone in this room understands it. No one can explain it. The next morning came. I bathed. I went to the restaurant. I sat down next to this handsome man. After I tried to eat and gagged on my breakfast, he turned to me and he said, in a very perceptive way, it looks like you've had a hard time. I didn't even bother to respond. He said, you know, I understand. I'm an alcoholic. And I said, well, I'm not. I have been in the past involved with drugs. And he said, you smell funny. And I said, well, I drink a little to stay off drugs. And he said, does it work? And I said, not at all. He said, I have some friends who might be able to help. Not having a lot on the schedule that day. And also, because of the look in his eye, I had begun to notice that look in a man's eyes. And I thought I had him categorized as an easy mark. It turned out he was. Just not the way I thought. I am very fond of saying that if you're a drunken junkie and if you sit down next to a handsome man in a restaurant and if you hustle him and if you end up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you've had it. You've just hustled yourself into the beginning of the end. So, dear sweet David took me that night to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before he took me to the meeting, however, he took me by a friend's house named Bill, and he left me with Bill while he went home and changed clothes. And Bill was an even taller, handsomer man. And Bill took me to bed, and then we all three went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I share that with you for a very specific reason. Number one, it's an important part of my life and my story. Number two, it took me a number of years to realize that there was absolutely no reason to feel guilty for the way I got here. I could not have gotten here any other way. I could not have wanted what you have any other way. I could never have been convinced that you offered me hope and happiness unless you had, in fact, offered it to me in the ways I then understood. You have to speak to people from where they're coming from. And God knew exactly where I was coming from. There was very little left of me that worked. Being a woman, that almost always works. And I found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous through my heart. I don't care what you call it. And I would like to say to those of you who have found it through your hearts that sobriety is the greatest gift I have ever been given. I no longer find it necessary to judge the way any of us get here. I do not believe there is a wrong way to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe there is only getting here. Because once we get here, the fellowship and the program does its magic. Through us and for us and to us in spite of us. I was not an easy... Cancel that. It was difficult for me to get a hold of this program. About the third day, I had been around the AA club in Kansas City, Missouri. A 12-step call came in, and I was hanging around. And the man who took the call said, "Will you come with me?" And I said, "Oh, no, I've only been around 2 or 3 days. He said, "You will come with me." I said, "I have absolutely nothing to offer." He said, "Honey, you're the best, worst example we've had in years." That's how I started, and that's where I started this remarkable journey. For the next year, I was in and out of AA. I did one thing right. I kept coming back. There's nothing else more right to do. There are lots of people who come to this fellowship and never drink again. There are lots of people who come to this fellowship while drinking and eventually stop. I found it very difficult to let go of alcohol and drugs. I believed so sincerely in the higher power they seemed to give me. It was not hard for me to turn my life and my will over to a power greater than myself. I had done it for years with alcohol and drugs. What was hard for me was to come to believe that there was a power greater than drugs. There was some magic more important, more fulfilling than scotch and morphine. That was the lesson you began to teach me. One day a friend of mine said, "Why don't we drive to upstate New York to an AA convention?" I said, "That sounds wonderful." We drove from Kansas City to upstate New York. You know how you do. Some of you have just done it. And at that convention, I did what I am very good at doing. I fell in love. He was a lovely, beautiful, magnificent man. If I tend to speak of him in the past tense, forgive me. He is still alive and well. Sober and happy in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tommy and I began a beautiful journey together. He was yet another man who realized, not intellectually, but the God in him spoke to the God in me. And he took me to bed so we could talk about the steps. It always works perfectly. I fell very much in love, and so did he. We began a journey together that was to last a perfect length of time. I know today that people always come into my life right on time and go out of it right on time. I'm very seldom ready for either. But I don't have to be ready in my head. My heart knows when it's time. And then it always happens. There isn't any way for it not to. So we took off for Laguna Beach, California, where God takes vacations. And I began for the first time in my life to live in a remarkable environment with three members of Alcoholics Anonymous, a man named Bobby, who some of you know, his wife at that time, a lovely lady named Taylor, and Tommy. Taylor was in the process of dying of cancer. And in one of our many conversations, she said, "You know, honey, one of these days when I'm feeling better, I would like to take you to a woman's stag in Laguna Beach. It meets on Monday nights." And I looked at her and I said, "My dear, as I understand the way this is written, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women." "I have never been to a woman's stag and I have no intention of going." And she laughed, a beautiful, wonderful, sincere laugh. And she said, "I understand and I will take you." Things progressed in our lives, and in April of 1973, Taylor was becoming weaker and weaker, and she said to me one day, "I have decided to give up this time and try it again another day." We had gotten some Valium to ease her pain, and it did not work. It intensified her pain. And Bob put it in a drawer along with the syringes, and he said, "Well, we'll have to return that to the pharmacy." I, being the best pharmacy I had ever met, was in a short time in that drawer, in the basement, with Valium and a syringe, trying to understand how you can be living with three members of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in the basement shooting Valium. How can that happen? On a Monday, early in the morning, I had not told anyone about my Valium use. It was not, after all, alcohol. And Bobby and I were sitting having coffee, and we were talking about how much better Taylor had gotten. I understand today that we were unkind in many ways to Taylor, because we said to her every day, "You're getting better." And we meant it one way, and she meant it another. She was getting better, but not the way we expected. She was coming closer to her perfect journey. Anyway, I said to Bob, "I have got to tell you something. I cannot stand not telling you anymore." I said, "I have been for the last few days down in the basement shooting Valium." And it was very quiet for a few minutes, and he looked at me and he said, "Don't you feel better now that you told somebody?" And that's all he ever said about it. Some years later, he said, "You know, that's the most chicken shit slip I ever heard of." That sounds like Bob, doesn't it? He said, here you are, a screaming junkie in Laguna Beach, California, with the best dope in the world, and you're downstairs shooting Valium? A couple of weeks later, Bob took Taylor to the hospital, and he called again on a Monday, and he said, the doctors tell me that Taylor will not make it through the night. And I said, we will wait here by the telephone to hear from me, from you. He said, no. He said, I would like for you to go to the Monday night woman's stag, and I would like for you to go for yourself, and I would like for you to go for me, and I would like for you especially to go for Taylor. Taylor died during that meeting that night. It has not been necessary for me to use a drug or take a drink since April the 15th, 1973. I believe she passed her gift of sobriety on to me in the only way she could leave it and in the only way I could take it. She got me to that meeting, and she kept me coming back to that meeting because men brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the women have helped me to stay here.
Right on.
Someone said today that they did not like women because they did not trust them. They did not believe them. I have come to understand that I did not like women because I did not like myself. It was a very simple reason and a very simple solution. The women in Alcoholics Anonymous loved me anyway. And they loved me until I could love myself. I have today what I call reflected glory. First you loved me, then I began a little bit to love you, and you flashed every bit of that love back to me 10 times greater, so that we have a giant give and take in this fellowship. The women in Alcoholics Anonymous in Laguna Beach, California are tough broads. And I'll tell you what, they allowed me the privilege of being just as arrogant, just as stupid, just as uppity as I had to be. And then they smiled, and they said, it's okay, honey. I understand. I've been there. You're going to be okay. Tommy and I had a wonderful life together there. We had the perfect AA marriage. And we worked with lots of people. We went to lots of meetings. We laughed and loved and learned a lot. We were very good for each other. While we were together, I returned to the university, completed my PhD. He wrote and had published 4 books. We brought out the best in each other. We nourished that as often and as long as we could. Now, one of the things that I have come to understand about relationships is that each person in that relationship changes each day of that relationship. There is, as far as I can tell, to this point in my life, no way to predict if those changes will be together or apart. One day, in June of 1977, Tommy came to me and he said, Cindy, something has changed. I'm going to move down the street. I said, you're what? What's changed? I had no idea that anything had changed. I'd been busy working on my degree. I hadn't noticed that anything was wrong. I have an uncanny ability to see things as they aren't. To see the world as I see it, and therefore as it is for me. I came to realize that he meant absolutely what he said. He, in fact, moved down the street. And a few weeks went by, and I was sitting in the living room with my dear friend Patty, and I was psychologizing. You know, I now have this degree in psychology. How to be able to figure this guy out. And I figure, well, he just needs to sort of work on his writer's block and get a few things sorted out here and there. And as I talked on and on, I noticed suddenly that the tears were rolling down Patty's face. I said, "My God, love, what in the world is wrong?" She said, "Cindy, don't you know Tommy's in love with another woman?" No, I didn't know. I had no idea. Everyone else knew. Now, let me paint a little picture for you. I had at that time 4.5 years of continuous sobriety. In this fellowship, I had worked the steps to the best of my ability. I had, in my opinion, spent a lot of my sobriety in service to others. I had, as I told my friend Chuck, been a very good girl. And he said, "Oh, you were in this for a trade?" I realized at that point that life is a series of ups and downs. And I had had 4 magnificent, wonderful, laughing years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what you had promised me was, in fact, coming true. You said to me, "If you will not drink, things will get better." Better laughter and better tears. Better joy and better pain. Everything has gotten better. I feel everything better. One of my greatest fears when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was that I could never love. I had somehow drowned my ability to care. I really didn't give a damn one way or the other. I discovered in the summer of 1977 that not only had I learned to love, but I had learned to care. I had learned to hope. I had learned a lot of things that I hadn't even expected I was learning. I believed that Tommy kept me sober. I believe that he helped me get sober, and that he helped me stay sober, and that without him, I would have no reason for sobriety. 4.5 years of continuous sobriety in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like to tell you that I went through that experience with dignity and grace. I heard somebody today say, a young woman, that her relationship had ended and she had not gone through it gracefully. I used to say that until I realized that, as a matter of fact, I did go through that experience filled with grace. It is the only way I could have survived. Tommy did for me what no one else could have done. He helped me discover my sobriety. He helped me discover my program, my growth. When I first got here, Marianne said, "We have a wonderful surprise for you." That surprise turned out to be a woman named Marion. Marion nursed me through that summer, as did many beautiful people in this fellowship. And she nursed me through in a way that we learn how to do for each other. She did not try to take away my pain. She did not try to remove my right to hurt and to grieve and to moan. I cried for weeks. I laughed and cried and cried and laughed. I talked and cried and laughed day after day. Those of you who have had the experience know what it's like to wake up every morning and think, "Oh my God, what am I going to do? How am I going to do it? And how long is this going to last?" Well, what I did is described beautifully by Woody Allen. He says that, as a matter of fact, 80% of life is just showing up. And that's all I did. That experience helped me realize that that's all I ever have to do. All I have to do is show up. That's how I got here. That's how I'll get wherever I'm going in the morning. I learned through those years how to take the 11th step. I had only taken it halfway for a long, long time. I would get up every morning, ask for the knowledge of God's will, and then wonder where it was. I know now the only thing I can do is get up every morning, report for duty, ask for the knowledge of God's will, and then know that that's what I have the rest of the day. Once in a while I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous do what I did for a long time, wonder about the difference between my will and God's will for me. I acted for a long time as if my will were the stronger of the two. As if there was something I could do that God disapproved of or that God would not allow. That is the size of my ego. A friend of mine suggests that I might rent a U-Haul someday for my ego. For me to believe that my will can outdo the will of God is quite remarkable. As Duffy says, I looked for God everywhere. And of course, that's where he is. Everywhere. There is no way to do anything but God's will. Now, I also know that he loves me enough to let me hurt myself, because I can throw myself against his will. I can pound my head on that wall, whatever it is. I can put my fingers in a door that is closing and leave them there until it is shut so tight and it hurts so bad that I cry for a long, long time. The only thing that ever really hurts me is my expectations. I expected Tommy to do something different from what Tommy did. I said to Bob Earl at one point, I said, you know, Bobby, I always knew that Tommy was attracted to other women. I have always been attracted to other men. My commitment to our relationship was simply stronger than any momentary attraction. I always knew Tommy was attracted to other women. I just thought he'd do something about it. Bob said, Cindy, he did. Tom was, as I understand it today, totally faithful to the only person to whom he could be totally faithful. I expected him to be faithful to me. That is an undue, irrational expectation. He was faithful to himself. You have taught me that every day of my sobriety, all you've ever expected is for me to be me. AA is, in fact, my guru, since I have come to understand that word in a different way. Think for a minute how you spell guru. G, you are you. A has taught me how to be me. Another beautiful line that says, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you you. That's exactly how this fellowship works. That's how God, as I understand God, works. I have had a number of other remarkable and enlightening experiences. They have lit me up from the inside out. That's why I call them enlightening. Because I have come to understand something I once thought to be one way in a whole new way. And that happens sometimes on a daily basis for a period of time. I have a son, a beautiful, remarkable son. And in 1970, I lost custody of him. I was declared an unfit mother by the state of Kansas. His father was awarded custody. For the next 7 years, I prayed daily to be allowed to share in my son's life. I know today why it took 7 years for that prayer to be answered. I could not have handled it one moment sooner. I almost couldn't handle it when it happened. Because in 1977, when my life fell apart, I learned also through that experience that every ending is, in fact, a new beginning. I am usually just so caught up in the ending that I fail to see the beginning for quite some time. I hope I am learning to see the beginning sooner, to take my attention off of the pain and put it onto the day. The only time it hurts is when I'm out of the now. When I'm right here, right now, it can't hurt. At any rate, I left Laguna Beach. The remarkable way that things happen in this fellowship, one day I was a happily married student living on the beach in Southern California. The next day, it seemed, I was a single professor living in the desert in Arizona. I have no idea what happened, absolutely none. As I understand it today, it's mainly because my life seems to be none of my business. And I know very well that I can wake up one morning and all of a sudden it's all different. There is absolutely nothing the same as it was the day before because I have become enlightened. Something has inspired me. It has happened within so that I no longer see the world in the way I once saw it. I got to the desert and I got into a job at the University of Arizona. And by the way, it's quite remarkable that if you live long enough and survive your experiences, there's no doubt in my mind but what one day it all makes sense. Because the job that I got in Tucson, Arizona is not a job that I would have ever thought to ask for. It was a job that somehow magically combined 15 years of drug addiction and alcoholism and 18 years of college education into a perfect opportunity to share both of those things. It took me, yes, 18 years to get through college. I was a freshman at Kansas University in 1959, and I finished my degree at University of California, Irvine in 1977. That is 18 years in college. I could have had I been a consistent student, several degrees. I have, as a matter of fact, only one. And as a doctor pointed out to me, the degree on my wall is not so much a sign of my success. It is instead a sign of my great fear of failure. I have a PhD, which in our society, in this country, is a reward for rigid thinking. I must share with you that the last 3 years of my life have been devoted to trying to undo what I have done after all those years in this education system. I would like not to have to be a linear thinker. I would like to be able to use more of my brain than I currently have access to. I shut it down for so long that I'm not sure it's still working. But I'm looking for it. At any rate, so I get to Tucson and I get my job and I get a phone call. And it is my dearest darling teenage son saying, "Guess what, Mother? I'm going to get on an airplane and I'm going to come and live with you."
At this point, please stop your machine and turn your tape over for the rest of the message. Thank you.
We then spent three of the most difficult, challenging, painful, excruciating, unpleasant years I have spent. I used to think I had trouble in love affairs. Those of you who have teenagers those of you who are teenagers know that there is nothing quite like what goes on between a mother and a teenage son. My friend Chuck pointed out to me that I was making a very simple mistake. I was trying to teach him how to cross the street in St. Louis, and he was in Cincinnati. We were not communicating. We did not communicate for a long, long time, except through third parties, policemen, counselors. You see, when I collect men, I have a remarkable way of doing it. My son, as a matter of fact, is 6'2" and very handsome, and eats $300-$400 worth of groceries a week, wears a size 13 shoe. I always seem to take on fairly big challenges, and I took him on, by God. I had my right to my pain, but by God, he wasn't going to have his. Somehow, I was going to interfere in his right to grow. Now, we all know that's impossible, thank God. I do not have that right, and I do not have that power, and I do not have that ability. Therefore, I did not get the job done. I was unable to lock him in a closet and let him out when he was 21 with two kids and a job in a bank. Things got worse and worse and more difficult, and I kicked him out, and then he left. And then he'd leave, and then I'd kick him out. And we'd always make up, and we'd always fight again. And about a year and a half ago, he made a decision that would never, ever in 100,000 years have occurred to me. That's why he made it. I had nothing to do with it. He joined the United States Army. Now, there is something magic I have decided about a sergeant in the United States Army. They seem to have a knack for discipline that escaped me. And when I asked my son how they did it, he said, "Mom, you know how they taught me to make a bed?" He said, "When I didn't make it right, they came in, ripped off the sheets, and said, 'Do 40 laps. I said, "Did you do it?" He said, "You bet I did it." It would never have occurred to me, and it wouldn't have worked if it had. He'd have just looked at me in his way and said, "You want me to what?" That was his favorite line. "You want me to what? Come on, Mom." I have a great challenge with my dearest, darling teenage son. He is today in Germany. Courtesy of the United States Army, he has learned how to repair helicopters. He has learned how to jump out of airplanes. He is a paratrooper. He is a remarkable young man. One brief incident will describe it, I think, better than anything else. All those years we lived together in Tucson, Arizona, and had all those fights and all those sleepless nights. When he got to basic training, he said, "Mom, I have decided that when I go to paratrooper school, I'm not going to tell you. I don't want you to worry." I said, "Cameron, how can you remove from me the right to do the one thing I do well?" The one thing I've really got a handle on is worrying about that kid. I understand today that worry is the ultimate ego trip, second only to guilt. I still have a large and healthy ego, so I still suffer from worry and guilt. I still have an undue sense of responsibility. Now, do you know that that child, as a matter of fact, did not call me for 2 months? I did not know if he was dead or alive. He called me one morning at 5 a.m. He said, "Mom, I just want to share with you that today I got my wings. I am a paratrooper." I said, "You mean you didn't call me?" "No." He said, "I didn't call you." So he's repairing helicopters somewhere in Germany. I can't even find it on the map. Do you know it's possible to worry about somebody when you don't even know where they are? I am trying to love him the way God loves me. I am trying to love him enough to let him have his life and to learn from the perfect journey that it is for each of us. There isn't any way for him to learn. I did not hear from him for about 3 months. And 2 weeks ago, I got a letter, and it started out, "Dear Mom, it hurts to ask, but how was Christmas?" It says, "I am painfully aware that I did not write, I did not call, and I did not send anything. I was too busy getting wasted trying to forget you. As you know, it did not work, and now I have the double pain of having missed Christmas and missing you. I would give anything to be able to prevent my son's experiences with alcohol and drugs. Thanks to God, I can't do that. Any more than my mother could prevent my experiences with drugs and alcohol. We cannot do that to each other or for each other. What you have taught me is how to honor those experiences, how to turn them into gifts, how to wear what I once wore with shame and humiliation with great dignity and joy today, how to turn all of the experiences that got me to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous from blows into blessings. I have also a wonderful father who happens to be a remarkable man. My sister, by the way, is here tonight. There's a research study that indicates that the daughters of alcoholic men are either themselves alcoholic or they marry alcoholics. My sister has married several. I am one, and I think I got the best deal. As the beautiful Al-Anon woman shared, they are, in fact, much sicker than we are. That is, by the way, information that I have gained from members of Al-Anon. I did not come up with that on my own. I was told that by members of Al-Anon. There isn't any other way that they could live with us. And in living with us, they share a lot of our tragedies. Now, in 1979, my 30-year-old brother took his life. It was a painful tragedy for all of us. We had all prayed for the knowledge of God's will for him on a daily basis. And when that knowledge came, we were unwilling to accept it. We did not want that answer. We did not want him to have a perfect journey in just that way. We wanted him to have it with us. He chose otherwise. My sister and I flew to Florida immediately to be with our mother and our father. My father was so drunk and such a mess and so unpleasant that even I noticed. Now that takes a lot. That really takes a lot, because Sally and I have talked a lot about the possibility of us having grown up in two different homes. It's absolutely amazing how differently we experienced our childhoods in the same home with the same parents. She saw my father as an unpleasant, hard-drinking, frightening man from a very early age. As far as I am concerned, my father was the most exciting, wonderful, beautiful, happy, lovely man I had ever known. I see exactly what I see. I create the world in which I live. Every day, today included. What I see because I want to. Today I have a little more choice in that. A lot more choice in that. At any rate, after a couple of days after my father's funeral, my brother's funeral, pardon me, My father kept talking about wanting to die and drinking more and more, and I did what you have taught me to do. I called the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, we need your help. Fortunately, I was unable to order just the person to call on my father, so God sent the perfect person, as always happens. And into my father's driveway drove a man driving a more expensive car than my dad drives, with a sticker on it from a better neighborhood than the one my father lives in. He had a better suntan than my father had. He had under his arm the book Alcoholics Anonymous. He swept into our living room. He put his arms around my father, and he said to my dad what you had said to me. Let us love you back into loving yourself. And I watched the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous begin for my father. Every ending has within it a new beginning. This March, my father will celebrate 4 years of continuous sobriety in this country. I know it's getting late. I want to tell you a little bit about what it's like today in my life. One of the promises I made to myself when I got sober has turned out like many of the promises I have made to myself. When I make a promise to myself, I create the necessity of having that experience. And I promised myself that one thing I would never, ever do is fool around with a married man. I had, after all, gotten through many years of drunkenness and drug addiction by fooling around with married men. It was a safe bet, and I decided that I would not have any part of that in sobriety. A friend of mine named Grady up at Fallen Leaf Lake says it beautifully. She says, whenever I judge another, when I look at someone and say, my God, how can she? God, as I understand God, says, well, honey, we're going to find out. I am learning very slowly to judge as little as possible, to compare as seldom as possible, because I know today that I will bring into my life everything I have found in others. That is why I look more often for love. Only love. As far as I'm concerned, there are two very simple ways to be in this world. You can either express love or ask for it. There isn't anything else. All of those difficult days with my teenage son, he was simply asking for love. It was hard for me to see it that way. Today I know that's what it was, and that's what it is. Today, I have a magnificent life because 3 years ago, a man named Joe appointed me to the program committee for the International Young People's Conference in Tucson, Arizona in 1980. Actually, it was 4 years ago. He also appointed a man named Bart and Bart's wife, Alice, to be the Al-Anon program chairman. And Alice and a woman named Nancy and Bart and I worked on the program together for a year. Bart and I had a wonderful platonic working relationship. We had a lot of intuitive information exchanged. Alice is a wonderful Al-Anon, and she kept saying, now quiet down, you two. You can't do it that way. You can't do it that quickly. You can't make those decisions so easily, and we did it anyway. And Bart went off to California with his wife and his two children and his new job, and he came back to Tucson in May of 1980 for the convention. And he called and he said, I need a ride over to the convention. Alice has gone to work. Can you pick me up? I said, sure. Wonderful to hear your voice. Haven't seen you for a while. Drove over to his house. He threw open the front door, and I said, oh, my God. Not this. Not now. I'm not ready. I can't handle it. Take away this feeling. I know I don't feel it. It can't be that. And just like that, I fell in love. Now, they don't call it that for nothing. They don't call it that for nothing. As it turned out, the same exact experience happened to him. It was a blinding experience. We spent the next 6 months in a remarkable emotional affair. I was flying around the country speaking, and he was flying around the country helping me speak. I was not at that time sharing that experience from the podium. It usually takes me a couple of years before I can talk about it. From up here. I have, however, discovered, as someone said so well, that I'm only as sick as my secrets, and pretty soon they will all come out, because you have invited me not to be sick anymore, and you have shown me how to do that. Bart and I have lived together for 2.5 years now. We have a beautiful love relationship. It is different for me in a lot of ways. What Tommy taught me, he taught me very well. He taught me that I had become addicted to his presence. The evidence of that was the severity of my withdrawal when he left. I have learned with Bart that love is not, as I once thought, exclusive. It is inclusive. The more I love him, the more I love you. The more I give, the more I have to give. The more I share, the more there is to share. We know today in our relationship that each of us is committed to personal daily growth. That growth today is bringing us closer together. That may not always be the case. I know today that Bart will be totally faithful to the one person he can be faithful to. Bart. I know today that whatever he does with a full heart. I know today that whatever I do with a full heart. We have come together in the beauty of this fellowship, not to take from each other, but to give to each other. And in giving to each other, so much is given to us. Our lives are full of many beautiful things. My job at the university is still very tenuous. It, too, has helped me learn to live one day at a time. In 1980, it was another one of those years I fell in love with Bart. My program at the university was put on suspension. I was awarded a fellowship by the Kellogg Foundation, which gave me the opportunity to grow personally and professionally for 3 years. As a result of that fellowship, in 2 weeks, Bart and I will leave for the island of Bali in Indonesia, and we will travel from Bali up through Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, and Thailand to Bangkok to study alternate states of consciousness as they occur naturally. I value being high. I love to be high. And there is no high higher than the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know today how to be high, how to be happy and healthy and very, very high. The great problem with drugs is that there is a limit to how high you can get. As far as I can tell in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is absolutely no limit, except those that I place upon myself. God, as I understand God, and I do understand God today, He works through me, through you, through every word that we speak to each other, for each other, with each other. Desire, as Bob says, means of the Father. God speaks to me from the inside and from the outside. He knows what I need because I know what I need. He walks with me into every experience, through every experience, out of every experience. He accompanies me every day in every way. God is, as I understand, a form of energy that is present in abundance in this room. Each of us is an expression of God. All of my efforts to disprove that have worked out to be absolute proof of it. Isn't it remarkable how often that works What I set out to disprove, I often discover to be the truth. My life in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me many things. It has taught me that a lot of us see things very differently. As Elsa says, if you and I were identical, one of us would not be necessary. Therefore, we are not identical. We read the book, and each of us interprets it individually, which is exactly the way it is meant to be interpreted. Some people say you should not get emotionally involved. That has not been my experience, and you will never hear me say it, because I do not believe it. When I came to this fellowship, I had been so unemotionally uninvolved for so long that I was afraid I'd never know how to again. AA has been for me an emotional involvement. You have literally turned me inside out. You have spilled my guts with me and for me. What Tommy did when he left was to crack me wide open. You see, there was no way for me to survive that experience being cool. He broke me out of it. He bent my knees. He helped me give up and surrender and say, "My God, I cannot handle it." Therefore, of course, as you all know, I could. Because every day of my life is a testimony to this fellowship, to how it works, to why it works, the ways in which it works. I see it as all of my experiences fell apart. They were all negative. Everyone harmed me in some way because that's what I invited into my life. Today, I am still very paranoid, in a positive paranoia that you have helped me develop, because I know today that the world is a conspiracy organized for my benefit. I know that everything happens to me because I have invited it into my life. It has happened to me because I have created the space for it to occur. When you walk into my life, I know you're there because I've brought you there. Every experience, every opportunity, every challenge that I have is tailor-made for my learning, loving, laughing, living in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how God works. God shows us every day His face in the mirror, in each other, in our lives together and apart. You have shown me through your lives and your love, through people like Marion, my sister Sally, how to let pain grow me, how to know that suffering brings grace, so what can hurt me? How to know that every experience I have is an opportunity to experience God's love, to know there is no sin. We are, in spite of our egos, sinless. It's a heavy burden, because what it does is to free us to be absolutely who we are today. Sin is, as a matter of fact, an old term from archery that means simply to miss the mark. In that sense, it's very easy not to sin. All you do is shoot, and whatever you hit, you call it the target. We are, therefore, without sin. We are, therefore, free not to have guilt unless we need it. I no longer need to punish myself with my past. I can instead offer to you as a gift of sobriety. In the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the remarkable thing is that you picked me up off the streets 11 years ago. You dusted me off, you gave me a life, you taught me how to love, you helped me learn, and then you asked me to come and share it with you. That is quite remarkable. Thank you for being you today and again tomorrow.